Chapter 1. Early Days. Look, dear, that's Mrs. Lambert Chambers. My long-awaited visit to Wimbledon had come to pass at last, and my father was pointing to a thin, slightly stooping figure practising on a nearby court. Until then, I knew only that Mrs. Chambers was a lawn tennis star whose name was spoken of with wonderment by everyone who had seen her play. As I saw for myself the long, sweeping strokes that flowed from her racket, and noticed the curious intensity of purpose that her bent shoulders seemed to impart to her every movement on the court, I realized instinctively that I was watching one of the world's greatest players. The romance of players on a tennis court, and of the crowds who thronged to watch them, began at Wimbledon in 1877. My Wimbledon story begins just 40 years later, when thoughts of tennis were mostly those of men on leave, or of women snatching hurried moments from their war work. Though what I saw with schoolgirl eyes when I made my first acquaintance with the All England Club was little different from the sight that had thrilled countless thousands in the early history of the game. Shady trees, emerald plots neatly lined in white, a small and friendly clubhouse. Only the emptiness of the courts and the gauntness of the long deserted stands brought a harsh echo of war conditions to Walpole Road in 1917. As I stood enthralled by the sight of Mrs. Chambers' searching drives, my father seized eagerly at the chance of a last game before returning to his ship. Before the war, his weekends had stood for the invariable ritual of early lunch, the 2:05 train from Earl's Court Station, followed by a much-discussed men's double, and since early childhood, I had heard stories of these weekly battles won and lost in company with the fabulous heroes of the All England Club, until I had come to think of Wimbledon as some enchanted land. Possibly my first visit to Walpole Road was on a lucky day, for on acquaintance the scene appeared no less enchanting than in my fancy. And from a grassy slope I remember imagining that in addition to Mrs. Chambers, all the characters of my childhood's story world were playing on the sunny courts. Mrs. Hilliard, the Doherty's, May Sutton Bundy, Norman Brooks, Wilding, the giants of tennis who had made their names famous on these very lawns, came to life before me in the shimmering haze of that magic afternoon. Just as my mother had described to me, spectators with huge feathered hats and gay parasols seemed to pace the paths with their escorts, to be admired themselves in moments of respite from the strenuous pastime of admiring others. Instead of the horse which had been grazing on the neglected tea lawn, strawberries and cream were being served from trestle tables to a long line of laughing people. A train rumbled past the centre court. I've never known how long I had been sitting there, but all too soon the figures of my reverie were caught up in the puffs of white smoke that rose skywards from its unseen course behind the stands. I heard my father calling me to come inside to tea. Inside the clubhouse, the pioneers of tennis and the even earlier croquet players for whom the velvet lawns of Walpole Road were planned still greeted me from every side, for the quiet, unpretentious tea room was lined with records of past champions' victories. In that drowsy little building, the birthplace of lawn tennis, the past was everywhere. Even the members seemed to speak in slightly lowered tones, as if their conversation might disturb the shadows. Through the long windows of the tea room, I could still see the gaunt outline of the deserted stand silhouetted against the pale blue sky, and I wondered if my dream scene would ever come to life. If I should ever really see the mighty champions battling on the centre court, or hear the cheering throngs about which I had heard so many stories. I could not know then that with my long-awaited introduction to the All England Club, I had been given a foretaste of my future. Back at school, I found it difficult to contain my impatience to visit Wimbledon again. I longed to see more of the great players, to feel for myself the thrill of mingling with the crowds, and to share with them the excitement of the championship meeting, which to me was still a figure of the imagination. The months dragged heavily until the next coincidence of my father's leave with my own end of term. When the great day came at last, my delight at the prospect of another afternoon at Walpole Road was intense. In contrast to my first visit, 6 courts were occupied on this occasion, and many little gatherings of friends and other players were watching their more energetic colleagues from the sidelines. Next to where I sat, I had noticed that an army officer was standing, fingering the silver top of the swagger stick that he carried with him. A moment later, an incident occurred that nearly brought my outing to an uncomfortable conclusion. For a cannonball service hit by one of the players we were both admiring suddenly came full tilt towards me. "Look out! Look out!" shouted the officer, as I ducked with as much dignity as I could summon. In that fleeting instant, his left hand shot out, and almost off my nose, the wayward ball was returned with perfect accuracy from the tip of his slender cane. Little as I knew then of the technicalities of the game, it was not difficult to appreciate the years of practice, the degree of coordination between eye and hand that was necessitated by that sudden gesture, and naturally, I was curious to know the officer's name. I could remember hearing that 10 years previously, Norman Brooks, a great Australian star, had shattered Wimbledon's complacency by taking the men's singles championship overseas for the first time in its history. I was soon to learn that it was Major Norman Brooks on duty in this country, who that afternoon had saved me from a nasty bruise and possibly a black eye. After his first successful challenge to the British champions of Wimbledon, Brooks had renewed his claim and won the men's title for the second time in 1914. Like Mrs. Chambers, he had thus remained the holder throughout the war. In 1919, 2 years after his timely intervention on my behalf, I was to see my gallant defender dethroned by his young compatriot, Gerald Patterson, in the first post-war championship meeting. For 5 long years, the gates of Wimbledon had been closed. With the return of peace, the All England Club's annual championships were not only revived, but electrified by the meteoric appearance of Suzanne Lenglen. And while this amazing French girl was carrying all before her among the women players, Patterson, Lycett, O'Hara Wood and Thomas, a quartet of new and vigorous young Australians, doffed their uniforms and swept through all the men's events. What feverish excitement was caused by that international invasion! 5 new champions at Wimbledon, and all of them from overseas. It was indicative of the swiftly changing times that not one British player emerged victorious from the first post-war gathering of the stars. In nearly half a century of lawn tennis, only 6 non-British players had ever been successful in storming the stronghold of Walpole Road. In the 2 decades that followed the armistice, France, America, Australia, Germany, South Africa, Belgium, Japan and Spain were all victorious on the centre court, while less than a score of British representatives were ever again among the title holders of any of the 5 annual events of Wimbledon. Gone was the unhurried succession of the early British masters. My ambition to see the famous championships was gratified at last, but the Wimbledon of my youthful dreams was obsolete. With the coming of worldwide competition to Walpole Road, the capital of lawn tennis assumed a new importance, but in so doing, its peaceful courts, intended for a leisurely national pastime, became an international battleground on which contenders from all 5 continents fought grimly for the prize of world supremacy.